The U.S. and China sign on to the Paris Agreement on climate.
China and the U.S. are the two leading sources of carbon dioxide. Together, they produce about 40%, 39%, I believe, of all the carbon dioxide emissions right now. But other countries, as they grow, produce more and more. And it takes enough signatories to the Paris Treaty to account for 55 countries and 55% of all pollutants. So for these two countries to sign puts you well on the way toward that 55% goal.
That's journalist Jack Cushman. He talks to us about his recent article for Inside Climate News, U.S. and China Ratify Paris Agreement. Then, what do you do when your country is facing the existential threat of sea level rise right now?
Climate change is an existential threat to a number of small islands. We're worried that in the future, in the not too distant future, we will no longer be viable human settlements. I mean, as I speak to you now, I look out onto the Caribbean Sea, and I'm worried, will I be able to pass on any land to my children, to my grandchildren? Will they be able to live here? So it's becoming quite stressful to think about what the future holds.
That's Dr. Hugh Seeley of Grenada. He was a climate negotiator on behalf of the small island nations during several of the global climate conferences that led to the Paris Agreement, and he wrote a manual on climate negotiation. Finally, humans once lived in harmony with the planet.
We have become disconnected. To go way, way back, human beings, we evolved to be hunter-gatherers, and we lived sustainably for millennia, and we existed peacefully with the planet. We had a niche. We had a niche that we fit into, and it was a stable niche.
That's environmentalist Peter Seidel. He talks to us about his book, There Is Still Time to Look at the Big Picture and Act. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us at this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. The Paris Climate Accord was finalized late last year. It was a historic agreement, but just because it was written didn't mean that it went into effect. That depends on getting 55 countries, who account together for at least 55% of global carbon pollution, to actually sign the agreement. Well, a huge step forward happened last week when President Obama and Chinese Premier Xi Jinping together signed onto the Paris Accord. We called up our go-to guy for such things, Jack Cushman of Inside Climate News. His article, U.S. and China Ratify Paris Agreement, Upping Pressure on Other Nations, was posted to the online Pulitzer Prize-winning news site on September 3rd. Well, Jack Cushman, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
I'm so glad to be here.
Now, you just wrote this piece for Inside Climate News, U.S. and China Ratify Paris Agreement, Upping Pressure on Other Nations. China and the U.S. are the two biggest emitters of carbon pollution, and they signed this pact the day before the meeting in China of the G20 group. First of all, tell us who the G20 is, and then what is the significance of their signing this pact at this time?
Right. The G20 is a large grouping of the more prosperous countries in the world, some of them still developing their way, and others big established powers like the United States, and it also includes all of the European Union. So it's a broad group of countries, and significant in this context because these nations account for almost all of the world's emissions of carbon dioxide, the pollutant that is causing the whole planet to warm.
And so the significance of their signing this pact at this time, you say this is going to up the pressure. Now
we're at some momentum. Mm-hmm. China and the U.S. Are, as you just said, the two leading sources of carbon dioxide. Together, they produce about 40%, 39%, I believe, of all the carbon dioxide emissions right now. But other countries, as they grow, produce more and more. And it takes enough signatories to the Paris Treaty to account for 55 countries and 55% of all pollutants to put the treaty into force. So for these two countries to sign puts you well on the way toward that 55% goal, although you need to have quite a good smattering of smaller emitters sign on. It would be a good thing to get this treaty into force by the end of the year. It would accelerate the movement that the treaty put into place toward eventually zero carbon economy all over the world.
Now, how far are we to that goal? How many countries have signed on? And, what's the next big target?
I think a few dozen countries have signed on at this point, but all of the countries aside from China and the U.S. that have signed so far represent only about 1% of emissions. So what you really need is the European Union countries and who are enthusiastic about this treaty by and large, and one or two other big players, Brazil, and I can't remember which countries have and haven't signed yet, but a few significant other countries. And there's no reason to doubt that that many countries will sign on in the months ahead and that the treaty will enter into force.
Well, Brazil has just had a kind of right-wing coup, it's being called, by folks who may not be all that friendly to this agreement. And India also has a very conservative prime minister. Those are two big ones. What are the prospects for them signing on now after the U.S. and China have?
I'm not expert enough to tell you what the state of play is in the Brazilian political scene. Brazil has been a leader among developing countries in getting this country and the world toward an agreement that will be acceptable to all. And I think one can hope that any Brazilian government will see it in its interest to proceed. India is not going to stand in the way of this climate treaty, but India may hold out a little longer than some to ratify, either because of domestic political considerations or to exert a little leverage. I think India would hope to see more signs of assistance from richer countries. India is a very large emitter of carbon dioxide, and its emissions are growing fast. So it's very important that they participate, and they have participated so far, and their government has taken important steps to reduce or curtail their emissions. However, in discussing countries like China, India, and the United States, one has to recognize that these countries are very different in economic terms and that their pollution records are very different. China has overtaken the United States as the biggest source of greenhouse gas pollutants, but the average Chinese only gives off half as much of this pollution as the average American does. And the average Indian only gives off maybe a tenth as much as the average American does. So the United States has particular responsibilities. China has particular responsibilities and opportunities. And India, in particular, is a place where one can look for enormous opportunities to control pollutants in the years ahead.
To kind of leapfrog over the carbon era.
Well, they're well into the carbon era already. I don't think that they can leapfrog. It's too late to leapfrog, but there is certainly ample time in a country in which hundreds of millions of people have no access to electricity to provide that electricity, which they desperately need and deserve to have, in a form that does not pollute the planet in ways that impose unacceptable risks. And so India is a country that may be able to meet its development objectives in a way that avoids the catastrophic consequences of pursuing you know, a 20th century or even a 19th century policy here when we're really well along into the 21st century.
Right. Now, the treaty's ultimate objective is to bring the whole world to zero net emissions of greenhouse gases as quickly as possible. What does as quickly as possible mean?
Well, nobody knows how quickly this can happen, but I think there's ample reason to believe that it can happen more quickly than was thought just a few years ago. We've seen dramatic gains in energy sources such as solar and wind, and dramatic gains in efficiency, and really comprehensive new understanding of what a new global energy economy would look like. And the experts tell us that there are many pathways by which the world can supply itself with the energy that's needed for sustainable development without sending us all over the precipice into a kind of climate oblivion, which would occur if you pursued business as usual from the 20th century. It's long past time to shift our investments from dirty energy to clean energy. There are lots of clean energy jobs that are available. There are many opportunities for innovation and for responsible energy development. And all over the world, people are working hard to shift what will have to be tens of trillions of dollars of investment away from wrongheaded approaches and toward sustainable approaches that will give us the energy we need and also save the planet.
But this is a voluntary agreement. Where are the teeth?
Well, this is a binding agreement in which countries are allowed to choose for themselves the pathways that, and the promises that they are going to pursue. Nobody has ever proposed a method of having a global treaty which binds every country, you know, close to 200 countries on Earth, to specific pathways with some kind of bludgeon to force them to do things that they perceive. So that's not the approach the world is taking. The world is taking an approach where they've laid out a pathway that makes sense to begin bending the curve. They are going to continue to revise their commitments, and the entry into force of this treaty will move up the opportunities for countries to revise and improve their pledges. And the world, you know, working together, is going to have to raise its ambition because we're perilously close to tipping into an area in which the pollution causes warming at unsafe levels for all of us.
Now, Obama does not need the consent of the U.S. Senate to ratify this agreement, but Republicans, including Donald Trump, who's pledged to block implementation of the Paris Accord, they dispute that.
Well, they can dispute it. They dispute many things. Most Republicans in Congress dispute that climate change is even caused by carbon pollution. So, and Donald Trump thinks the whole notion of climate change is a hoax that was invented by the Chinese to gain some kind of advantage on the international stage. So when you hear that kind of denial on the basic science, you have to question as well the kind of legal curlicues that are used to contend that this agreement is outside of the president's powers. There's a substantial legal construct and ample reason to understand that the president is well within his powers here. And the reason is that the treaty under which this agreement was reached is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. It was signed, sealed, and delivered decades ago, and it was unanimously ratified by the U.S. Senate. So under that treaty, other agreements like the Kyoto Protocol, which the U.S. backed out of, and the Paris Agreement, which the U.S. has just signed, are not the kind of treaty that needs to be ratified by the U.S. Senate. And I think that there's very little evidence that anybody is going to successfully challenge this agreement on those grounds.
And we can all laud President Obama for signing this treaty, but sometimes it seems as if his actions on the climate are a case of cognitive dissonance. He's pushing very hard for the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would give unelected investor tribunals power to challenge environmental laws. Basically, thereby, you know, sabotaging, holds out the possibility of sabotaging environmental laws as well as other laws that are passed under, you know, national sovereignty. What would be the impact of the TPP on the climate pact?
Well, you're correct that there's a lot of resistance to the U.S. Joining the TPP on the grounds that its environmental provisions are not strong enough. However, I don't think that the TPP would have any direct effect on the climate pact. In fact, you know, international trade agreements, which set the rules for worldwide commerce, quite strongly resemble treaty negotiations on things like pollution control. You know, whether it's the treaty that successfully stopped us from burning a hole in the ozone to the treaty that is attempting to stop us from raising the temperature of the planet. These are all agreements that set out frameworks for nations to move forward together. Now, to have an effective trade agreement, you have to negotiate terms that are acceptable all around. And it's not clear that the TPP has mustered that kind of support in Congress. President Obama, as you rightly point out, is a pro-trade president, and he's going to take one last swing, I guess, at the TPP. But I think it's you'd be hard-pressed to believe that that agreement is going to be ratified this fall in the current political environment.
Well, Jack Cushman, thank you so much for talking with us about your articles just come in, just been published in the last few days on Inside Climate News, U.S. and China Ratify Paris Agreement, Upping Pressure on Other Nations.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to talk to you anytime.
Jack Cushman of Inside Climate News. Find a link to his article, U.S. and China Ratify Paris Agreement, at writersvoice.net. We post our podcast on Thursdays. We post our podcast and show page on Thursdays. Next, Dr. Hugh Seeley of the small island nation of Grenada. Stay tuned. Hi, Francesca Rhiannon here, host of Writer's Voice. If you like Writer's Voice, please let your radio station know you appreciate them airing our show. And if you subscribe to our podcast, be sure to give us a good rating on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. Thanks, and welcome back. Our show today is inspired by the historic signing to the Paris Climate Agreement by the world's two major carbon-polluting nations, the U.S. and China. One nation facing an existential threat from sea level rise due to climate change is the small island nation of Grenada. Dr. Hugh Seeley has been on the front lines of that nation's struggle to get the world behind a strong climate agenda. He wrote the Negotiator's Guide to COP21, a manual for those representing the small island states at the Paris Climate Talks, and he served as a senior negotiator for the AOSIS, or Alliance of Small Island States Climate Change Technical Negotiating Team. He also was on the executive board of the Clean Development Mechanism under the United Nations Framework Convention for Climate Change. He's a professor in the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at St. George's University in Grenada. Well, Dr. Hugh Seeley, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Now, you are a professor in the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine, in the School of Medicine at St. George's University in Grenada. The Zika virus is much on the minds of the public these days. Before we get into your plan for a Caribbean carbon market, I wonder if we could talk a bit about the health implications of climate change, because there are connections that are being drawn between the spread of the Zika virus and climate change.
Oh, absolutely. I would label climate change as the potentially the greatest public health threat faced by mankind. That the Lancet, in an article last year, indicated that it's probably the greatest public health threat faced in the 21st century. Zika, dengue, chikungunya, all spread by mosquitoes that are going to incubate faster, live longer, and spread to regions where they weren't before.
Now, that's not the only health implications. I mean, there is a spread of diseases.
Oh, of course not. I mean, Francesca, you've got direct impacts like heat waves being experienced in Europe right now, India, Pakistan. You've got extreme weather events, floods that are occurring in Louisiana and China right now. Hurricanes. There'll be more Category 5 hurricanes than we've ever had before. Sea level rise is going to be an existential threat to low-lying coastal communities and all small islands. So, yeah, the list goes on and on and on. Loss in agricultural productivity. So food is going to become an issue as the temperatures continue to soar. It's going to just continue to be threats one way or another.
Now, you are from an island nation. In fact, you are the representative to the executive board of the Clean Development Mechanism, which we'll get into later.
I was, yes. I was on that board for 8 years. I resigned from that board as of last year, so I'm no longer on that board.
But you were representative from the Small Island Nations, the Alliance of Small Island States, AOSIS. Now, we're talking, I'm talking to you from East Hampton, New York, which is also on the front lines of sea level rise here. Luckily, my house is on a little bit of a rise. I might have beachfront property in another 50 years here. But this is a real threat to us as well. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about what it's like to be from an island nation, what the threats your country is facing, and what it's like to be in the position that you're in.
Climate change is an existential threat to a number of small islands. It's just not an economic. We're worried that in the future, in the not too distant future, we will no longer be viable human settlements. I mean, as I speak to you now, I look out onto the Caribbean Sea, and I know it's going to be inevitable. There is going to be at least 1 meter of sea level rise. And I'm worried, will I be able to pass on any land to my children, to my grandchildren? Will they be able to live here? So it's becoming quite stressful to think about what the future holds.
Now, there are differing forecasts about sea level rise, ranging from 1 meter to 3 meters by 2100. And some, including the world's leading climate scientist, James Hansen, say that we could be seeing levels like that as soon as 50 years from now. I wonder if you could talk about the science around sea level rise.
Well, currently, I think the world is, on average, is seeing about 3 millimeters of sea level rise per year, but that number is actually accelerating. And you're absolutely correct. The numbers that we see right now come in from two things, ocean warming. As water gets warmer, it expands, and also accelerated glacier melt that we had not anticipated. So sea levels are rising faster than science had predicted, which is not good news. And it looks like if we're locked into at least 1 meter of sea level rise, it could be more. If the West Antarctica ice sheets melt and Greenland melts, then all bets are off. I think we're talking about several meters of sea level rise, up to 7 meters of sea level rise, which would totally obliterate low-lying communities around the world, not only small islands, but most of New York, et cetera, would be underwater. That's absolutely frightening. I mean, along with the sea level rise, we're facing acidification of the oceans. The oceans are getting more acidic, and for small islands that rely on coral reefs, not only to protect their coastal zones, but to create those white sand beaches that the tourists love to come and visit. That's also going to be a huge economic impact on us if we lose our coral reefs.
7 meters of sea level rise by when?
Oh, that's over the next few centuries. That's going to be, because when you talk about sea level rise, you're not talking about something on a yearly basis. You're talking about geological time. You're talking about over centuries. That's why we're saying that by the end of this century, we are locked into at least 1 meter of sea level rise. And it could be as much as 2 meters of sea level rise. But if Greenland goes, if West Antarctica goes, over the next hundreds of years, we will see 7 meters of sea level rise.
Go a little deeper into this, because you say we're already locked into 1, possibly 2 meters, that is, 3 to 6 feet of sea level rise. What about the feedback loops that we are beginning to see? For example, with the melting of the permafrost in the Arctic, you're having a greater release of CO2, of carbon dioxide, into the atmosphere. With the droughts, record-level droughts that are occurring, you're having wildfire season, for example, in California, that is basically all year round, which also releases huge amounts into the atmosphere. You have the spread.
The melting of the polar ice caps is another positive feedback loop. So you've mentioned three so far, and there are others. And that's extremely worrisome, because it means then that we are approaching runaway climate change. We are approaching a point where the snowball, or the lack of a snowball, is running down the hill and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it might get to a point where we can't stop it. And it might get to what we call a tipping point. And the scientists aren't exactly sure how far away we are from that tipping point, but we're all getting quite nervous that it's just around the corner. Some scientists are arguing that, that we had the Paris Agreement. It was a historic agreement. I was one of the negotiators for the Alliance of Small Island States, and we left Paris in December of last year, exhilarated that we had achieved our primary goal of getting the world to recognize 1.5 degrees of warming rather than 2 degrees as a target. But now, several months later, I'm starting to realize that 1.5 degrees may not be attainable. If we cannot curb our emissions drastically within the next decade, then achieving that or limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees becomes almost impossible. And we already know for small islands that 2 degrees of warming is too much. So this is not good news for us. But the path that the world is on, even post-Paris, is not a good one.
And you say even post-Paris. I mean, Jim Hansen called the Paris Agreement, I think he possibly was a little extreme, but he called it a fraud, very much because of the same reasons that you have just talked about. He was trying to draw attention to the fact that it's too little.
I wouldn't be that extreme. I understand his frustration, because if you add up the promises made, the voluntary promises made by all the countries in Paris, we would still exceed 3 degrees of warming. So we know we have to do more. But Paris was historic in the sense that for the first time, all of the countries took on these commitments. And it wasn't just the developed world. The developing world has also stepped up and said, yes, okay, we know that we have to curb our emissions too. And that's a step in the right direction. But we have to do more than just step in the right direction. We have to run as quickly as we can, or else we will not be able to stop this train.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Dr. Hugh Seeley. He was a negotiator at the climate conferences that culminated in the Paris Climate Accord of 2015 and wrote the negotiator's manual. So as a negotiator at the Paris Climate Agreements, what are the barriers to running in the right direction when we so desperately need to do that?
Short-term economic outlooks. We're still locked into a fossil fuel world. And it's going to be very, very difficult for us to extricate ourselves from from use in fossil fuels, especially at a time when the world had gone into a recession in 2008 and is still trying to recover from that. And the economists keep on speaking about generating growth rather than curbing emissions. So we met in Paris, but then in December, but then the world economic leaders met in Davos just a month or so later and seemed to forget about climate change and went back to the short-term problems of spurring economic growth.
So now this comes to some of the market solutions that you have proposed. One of them that's that Hansen is in agreement with you on is a carbon tax. You're proposing a carbon market for the Caribbean. Tell us how a carbon tax works. Are there better or worse carbon taxes? In other words, what kind of carbon tax do you need in order for it to work to help us run in the right direction?
Well, instead of using carbon tax, let's use a more generic term and say that we need to put a price on carbon. The environmentalists would say that we need to internalize the external impacts of combusting carbon. So we need a price, and that can be done by imposing a tax on the use of carbon, or it can be done by what's called a cap and trade, where you cap the level of emissions and you allow industry to trade carbon credits within that cap, which is what California has done, Quebec has done, a number of eastern seaboard U.S. states have done under the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, what's called the RGGI. And there are a number of these domestic carbon markets that have been set up around the world. And I used to be the chairman of the Clean Development Mechanism, which is an international trading mechanism for carbon. And our interest here in the Caribbean is now under Article 6 of the Paris Agreement. Article 6 allows for a new international carbon market to be created and also allows for linkages between these domestic carbon markets and the use of these domestic credits for compliance with your international promises that you've made under the Paris Agreement. So we're in the Caribbean, we're interested in that because we did not benefit relatively from the CDM. There were a few projects under the Clean Development Mechanism that we got, but countries like India, Brazil, and China benefited more than small islands. And we don't want the same thing to happen with the new mechanism under Article 6. So we just recently convened a meeting of regional leaders in the climate sector here at St. George's University to look at the opportunities for the Caribbean to benefit from Article 6 and to help them transform their economies onto low-carbon, climate-resilient pathways.
There has been some criticism, however, of cap-and-trade because the price of carbon has been set too low to be effective.
Absolutely. I agree. And I presided over the CDM when the price of carbon collapsed. When I joined the CDM in 2007, the carbon was trading at over $10 a ton. When I left the board, we were at 30 cents a ton, and the price had collapsed. So you're absolutely right that for this thing to work, there must be an effective price.
And what would that be?
Well, I'm not an economist, but if I was to throw a number out at you, I would love it to see it over $20 or $30 U.S. dollars per ton.
There are many who say it needs to be closer to $100 a ton.
I'm being realist rather than optimistic, but you're right that there has to be a strong price signal that is sent, and it is unfortunate that at the same time when we have this urgency to decarbonize our economies, we have this price war going on with oil, and the price of oil recently is going back up, but the price of oil dropped, and again our short term economic planners have shelved their renewable energy projects because the price of oil has dropped in the short term. And that, quite frankly, is myopic.
So I guess this is my question, and I should reveal that for several years I worked as a sustainability journalist for CSR Wire. I came away from that experience questioning whether markets really can do the job that we need to have done within the time that we have.
Well, they can't do it all. I would be the first one to put my hand up and say that markets cannot be the only tool in our shed to fight climate change. Absolutely not. We're going to need regulation as well. We're going to need strong energy efficiency standards, particularly in the developed countries, if we're going to get onto the right trajectory quickly. But markets do have a role to play. And there's a strong incentive there because the marginal cost of abatement, in simple terms, it costs me less in a developing country to reduce a ton of carbon than it does in a developed country. So let's use those margins. And because the developing countries could do with the finance as well. So I am a strong believer that the markets do have a role to play if we do not provide perverse incentives, if the markets are well regulated, and if they accompany other measures, other non-market approaches.
A difficult thing to do when you have so much regulatory capture around the world by the fossil fuel industry, isn't that so?
Some have argued that climate change negotiations are a proxy war on fossil fuels. I think that the fossil fuel industry has recognized that and is doing everything that it can to maintain the status quo. But a paradigm shift has to occur.
Now, just talking about the Caribbean carbon market, Cuba is part of the Caribbean. Would it be part of a carbon market as well?
That's a good question. And this thought about a Caribbean carbon market is in its conceptual stage. There are a number of boundaries you could potentially put around it. You could call it within CARICOM, which is just the English-speaking Caribbean community that's formed a common market. Or you could expand it to include Cuba and the Dominican Republic. And I think the larger the market, the more viable the market will be. And I think that's why already at the conceptual stage we recognize that the Caribbean is still a small region. And for liquidity, you would want to link that market to even larger markets, perhaps in the U.S. and in Latin America.
And just to stay on Cuba for another minute, it's seeking to develop big oil fields offshore. So here we have the same kind of dilemma.
All of us are schizophrenic when it comes to our energy sectors. All of us are saying that we need to reduce our emissions, but yet drilling for oil at the same time. Absolutely schizophrenic.
So what is the remedy for that?
If I could wave a wand, I would say put a moratorium on all future oil and gas exploration and put a moratorium on all coal immediately. Now, do you tell me if I can get that done?
I think it's going to take a mass movement to do it. It can't just be, in other words, at the boardroom or at the negotiating table. It needs to be
something
pressed.
Has to happen to make us realize that is where we have to go. That we have to stop combusting fossil fuels. There is no way that we can meet. I mean, Paris talked about 1.5 and 2 degrees, yes, but Paris also talked about net zero emissions in the second half of this century. So that by 2050, in ordinary terms, we're supposed to stop putting carbon into the atmosphere.
Entirely.
Well, it says net zero. Net zero assumes that we're gonna develop technology for negative emissions, and only us negotiators could come up with such a term, negative emissions, which basically means you invent technology that can strip the carbon back out of the atmosphere. And what we're saying and what we've said in Article 4 of the Paris Agreement is that we aim to achieve net zero emissions in the second half of this century. Now, you're telling me how we're going to get net zero emissions if we continue to combust fossil fuels. We can't. There must be a revolution in our energy sectors. And that includes transport as well.
And I recently saw an article that said that solar energy is actually getting cheaper than coal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A revolution occurring. Prices in solar are dropping tremendously. So much so that it's also affecting the electricity generation models that have been normally used with centralized generation of electricity by a utility company, and then they send that electricity out through a network of transmission and distribution lines. Nowadays, I can put a solar PV on my home, and I can generate electricity competitively and sometimes more cheaply than I can get it from the utility company. The utility companies recognize this, as well, and they see that this as a as an existential threat to their to their companies as well.
Which,
so that part is exciting. The fact is that the technology is now there to allow us to make this shift in our energy sector without affecting our quality of life. And I think that's absolutely important, especially for those of us, and I count myself as well, in the West, that want to maintain the quality of life that we have and that our children will also have that quality of life. And my argument is we can maintain that quality of life and stop burning coal.
Well, from your mouth to God's ear, as we say here in New York, Dr. Hugh Seeley, thank you so much for talking with us. You're a professor in the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine, Environmental and Occupational Health at St. George's University in Grenada. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Hugh Seeley. Go to writersvoice.net to find out more about his work. Coming up, environmentalist Peter Seidel. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Our final segment today features a conversation I had earlier last spring with environmentalist and author Peter Seidel. When I first saw the title of his book, There Is Still Time to Look at the Big Picture and Act, it sparked hope in my heart, a heart that is often burdened by the seeming intractability of the environmental challenges we face. Yet Seidel says that if we all take some responsibility for making things better, we still have time to save the world we love and bequeath it to our children. Peter Seidel, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you.
Now, this book has an unusual title because the subtitle actually comes before the main title. Looming ahead of us, a point beyond which there is no return, but there is still time. This book, it seems, is very much about trying to get at the mindset that we have and the one that we and how we need to change it in order to really deal with the incredible crises that face us. You know, you started the book talking about how, you know, the obvious that we are totally dependent on our environment, and on the other hand, we are totally disconnected from that awareness. Talk a little bit about what you mean by that.
Well, we have become disconnected. To go way, way back, human beings, we evolved to be hunter-gatherers. And we lived sustainably for millennia as hunter-gatherers. You know, this went on and ended, and we existed peacefully with the planet. I mean, everything was not always comfortable. I mean, sometimes people starved because there wasn't enough to eat. There were probably sometimes occasional diseases or health problems, but probably not the disease like is rampant today with the high population densities and travel that we do. But we had a niche. We had a niche that we fit into, and it was a stable niche. And then we tried to get rid of some of these things that were disturbing us, like not having enough food. So we got into agriculture, and eventually into medicines, and then eventually came the Industrial Revolution, and since then things started to change rapidly. And well, since I've been born, I was born a long time ago, there are more than 3.5 times as many people on the planet as there are today. Since I've been born, in 1950 there were 2.5 billion. Now there's over 7.3 billion and growing. So this, we've got to respond to these things and put the brakes on it. What's happening right now is actually an explosion. It's an explosion of our impact on the planet.
Yeah, in fact, you mentioned Paul Ehrlich, who we spoke with recently, about an idea that he put forward way back when, along with John Holdren, who used to be President Obama's science advisor.
Right.
And that concept is goes by the acronym IPAT. Could you say what that is?
Well, the IPAC, I stands for impact. This is a very important formula, and everyone should be aware of it. And I mention it quite often in the book. I equals impact. In other words, that's the impact that we as humans put on the planet. And it is caused by the population, which is P, times affluence is how we live, times technology, whatever technology we have, whether it's improving things or getting worse things. Anyhow, you multiply these things out, and you get what we're, you know, the total impact of what we're doing on the planet. It's right there.
Yeah, and, you know, I think as most of my listeners know, we're pretty aware of the impact that we have. And yet it just does seem that it's so difficult to do anything about it. What are some of the, you talk, I think, a lot about the hard wiring of our systems, of our consciousness that is not hardwired to really deal with that. What are some of the different points that you make about that?
Well, our brain, actually, it evolved to function as hunter-gatherers. And actually, the evolution of our brain, it started as humans. The most primitive parts of our brain, the earliest parts of our brain were the most primitive, just above the brainstem. Then it has grown out from there. But these parts right above the brainstem, which are emotions and things like fear and hostility, you know, competition, hostility, a lot of these things have a tremendous influence on us today. And these things are causing us a lot of trouble today. We've got to get past that and deal with a world that we actually are not fit to live in. And I think it's quite clear that we're not fit to live in it. If you look at how we deal with each other, the fact, you know, the United States and the Soviet Union finally agreed to cut down our 220,000 nuclear weapons down to 1550 each. Can you imagine that? I calculated. I hope my math is bad. I hope so. But I calculated the worst one of those could be 600 times more powerful than the one we dropped on Hiroshima. So we have these terrible weapons that we can use on each other, which makes no sense at all. We're certainly a strange problem species, creating terrible problems for each other and for the planet, both. In both of these areas, we're really not suitable for living on the planet as it is today.
You know, you talk about how we're hardwired for short-term thinking and, you know, for competition and for aggression. Then I think, like, well, how is there still time then? I mean, if this is how we're hardwired, we can't deal with crises until they've already overwhelmed us. Then how is there any hope to do anything different?
Well, I think we have to do our best to do, and hopefully we can.
But how? How can we? Because you're not only talking about, you know, kind of the ways our brains work, but we have a whole social system that is set up to prevent us from actually dealing with these problems. You know, I sometimes think we, you know, this is like Murphy's Law. We have the worst possible economic and political system to be able to deal with the crises we face. And now, you know, as you talk about, we also don't have, you know, kind of our evolution hasn't caught up to the problem. So what specifically are things that we can do to, you know, begin to change the way we think?
One thing I think that we have to become better than what we are. Ortega y Gasset wrote a very interesting book around 1930 called The Revolt of the Masses. And he defined mass man as the person who is just happy with being what he is. And I think we've got to get beyond that. Now, I don't know if it's possible, but we all have to say, you know, this is the way I feel. This is my natural inclinations, but I better do better. And if we can do that, we can overcome a lot of these problems that we have with it that are inherent in us, and step beyond them, and become suitable to live in this world that we've created.
So, walk us through some of the specific suggestions, because you have quite a few of them in the book, of ways that we could be better than we are. and what how we can specifically begin to put some of that into practice in our own lives?
One of the first ones is we have to say we're going to do better. And I know that some people, there are people who do pass beyond this mass man. The great mass of humanity is like this mass man, but there are people who push themselves and do better, and we have to do that on a larger scale. And that's one of the first things, is pushing ourselves to do better. Then we need to look at the whole picture instead of just the parts. And we've got to start to put pieces together and see that everything is interconnected, that, you know, we do one thing over here and affects something else over here.
Well, some of the things you talk about in terms of making connections with each other is you talk about the need for different groups to begin to work together in coalitions.
Yeah, well, that I get to in the last chapter, yes, because there are a lot of things that I talk about that we should do as a society, is like this seeing everything as a whole. And we have to see the importance of living at peace with each other, that we cannot go on like we are. Now what we are is we have a nation full, a world full of separate groups called nations. And sometimes these are divided up, or often are. And these nations refuse to cooperate on a really grand scale. We have, fortunately, we're coming to some things like this last meeting in Paris, where we are agreeing to trying to do some things. But I'm afraid when these people get home and talk to their local people are going to say, no, we're not going to do that. So basically, we have to, as a species, we have to start seeing ourselves as a species confronting an environment which is threatening us.
You know, one of the things that I took away from your book, Peter Seidel, There Is Still Time, was ways that we can actually work on the local level. For example, I'm right now engaged in trying to bring together all different kinds of groups in the area in which I am, housing groups and groups working on you know, prison justice, and groups working on farming and food systems and transportation systems and climate resilience, to come together and to begin to talk together, identify ways in which we can help each other's struggles and ways in which we can work together to move the levers that can help us all. That's just bringing local groups together, but I've been very frustrated over many years to see so much great work being done by so many individual groups that never talk to each other. They're small, they don't have much of a lever because they are small, and if we all got together, how much more power we could have.
Yes, and on a global scale. You know, if the people who are trying to save the whales and the people who are trying to save the bonobos or the chimpanzees and the people who are trying to save the Amazon forest and the people who are trying to deal with climate change, if they all saw and worked together, like you're saying, on a global scale, because all these problems are worldwide, the ones that I just mentioned, if they work to come together and work on a global scale, they can find that they can have much more power, and that they recognize this IPATH formula, that population and affluence are at the root of the problem, that then these groups can start supporting each other. In other words, the ones that are working on one thing can say, well, you know, we work on this, but also, you know, all these fit together. And working together to make us a better community and solving all of these problems, well, each one of us does work on our individual problem because we need to continue to do that, but also coming together and recognizing that we're all part of the same problem.
Peter Seidel. I should admit that my plans to get my community together were interrupted by this year's presidential primaries. After the election, I look forward to taking up that thread again. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox. or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.